but I'm not just going to dollar cost average in and do that shit, like, because risk matters to me.
Mm-hmm.
And if risk matters, well, then you do need to consider technical analysis because there is something there. And all these people who say technical analysis only works because other people do it and because everybody uses it, well, I don't give a shit why it works.
It works. If right? it works, yeah. You're still saying it works.
If it fucking works, it works. I don't care.
Longtime fans of the show should be familiar with the lender formerly known as Sue Pullen, and I'm pleased to announce that she's back, fresh off a rebrand and ready to help as Sue Mackey. Sue is a certified mortgage advisor at Fairway Independent Mortgage, an equal housing lender who focuses on finding the right product for you and your needs. She has over 20 years of experience helping thousands of homeowners. Whether it's purchasing, refinancing, or even a reverse mortgage, Sue will help. Sue's licensed in 36 states now, so reach out and let Sue Mackey it happen for you. The best way to reach her is just give her a call at 520-977-7904 or in an email, spullen@fairwaymc.com. Fairway Independent Mortgage has an MLS number of 2289. Sue Mackey has an MLS number of 206048. That email again, spullen@fairwaymc.com. And that phone number is 520-977-7904. Shoot Sue an email and let her know she needs to update that address. Disclaimer time. This is where I tell everyone to lighten up. It's just a podcast. Trading is like that roller coaster at the amusement park. Thrilling, unpredictable, and potentially stomach churning. What works for one person might leave another clutching their hat in the wind. Our hosts and guests, they're awesome, knowledgeable, full of insights, but we're not financial advisors. So don't rush to make any investment decisions based solely on our banter. Always consult with a professional or do your own research. Plus, let's face it, we like to have fun, laugh, enjoy the trading ride together. It's all in the name of good podcasting fun. So remember, take it easy, don't bet the farm, and keep your seatbelts on at all times. Thank you for listening.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the China Shop, home of the Band of Traders podcast. I am your host, Kyle, and joining me tonight, I've got Bear Goes Long. And not only we got Purdue back with us tonight, but he also brought a special guest. We got Cam, a fellow Navy vet, consultant, eight-figure investor and trader. And when I say fellow, he's a fellow Navy vet. We may be investors and traders, but I'm not eight figures unless you combine my two bank accounts together. Yeah, four figures plus four figures is eight, right?
Yeah, that's how it works.
You can follow Cam over at Camonomic on Twitter. Did I say that right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Okay. And if you want to learn more about what he's doing, you can find links on there in the bio. I don't know how that is for a introduction, Mike, but I don't know if you want to take over from there and kind of give us a little bit more background on how you and Cam found each other.
Yeah, so I found Cam through another guy that I met named $2 Bala. God, Cam, he changed his name. He actually came public who he is, yeah. And I'm forgetting it.
Yeah, me too.
But that's the way I remember in my head. And he basically created this Discord room that was comprised of members that were all active or former veterans or active service members that were interested in trading. And he brought together successful traders to try and bring everyone together to show, you know, these are successful traders. This is how they trade. Basically was highlighting how individually and how unique each one of them are in their own different ways and how successful they are in their own individual ways. And one that caught my attention was Cam, and eventually he came around and started his own room, and I've been paying attention to what he's been talking about and showing and sharing, and I just find it fascinating. I thought you two, as far as this podcast would go, would be a very interesting conversation.
Oh God, yeah. I think you brought us a few guests in the past, and all of them have always been great. So yeah, thanks for the find here. Cam, thanks for taking the time to join us. Why don't you start off by just kind of, I guess, filling in the link. Like, how'd you go from Navy to trader or consultant or, you know, any one of those other bullets I mentioned on the way up here?
So, you know, getting out of the Navy, I guess it goes back to, like, I grew up on a tobacco farm in North Carolina, dirt poor, middle of nowhere, you know, like, making money, retiring was like, I mean, that's not what farmers do, right? Like, farmers don't retire. Like, when you stop working, you have no money and you die, right? So, so the only way out of that for me or anybody in my family was, you know, I mean, one, you can try and go to college, but again, you know, I came from the middle of nowhere. So even in the, you know, mid and late 90s, it was like, that's probably not the case. Mm-hmm. Or go into military. Yeah. I mean, going into military was always what I wanted to do. I got a chance to do that. You know, went in as a corpsman, made my way to the Naval Academy. When I got out, you know, I kind of had a bad taste in my mouth for the military and, you know, just needed to get away from that life. I didn't want to get sucked into, you know, contracting or anything like that. You know, I knew some guys that did that and it just felt like a kind of a trap. Like you get caught in that life and like, you don't really pick up any skills, but you make some money. But then you get done with a contract, you get done with doing that, and you're in the same position. You don't really have any skills that like the regular world cares about, but you made some money. And like, I didn't want to get into that. I kind of wanted to do something else.
There's no real career there, right?
I didn't see a long-term path there.
Barry, you used to do that. Would you agree with that?
And maybe I'm wrong. Yeah. Completely, you know, maybe I'm wrong, but just for me,
No. And contracting is a very, very broad term. I did IT security and basically, you know, I grew up in a military family. I wanted to like go into the military straight out of high school. And unfortunately, my dad and my stepmom were officers. And they're like, no, go to college.
Good on them.
And I mean, my dad literally said to me, he goes, you might survive as an officer, but you're definitely going to fail enlisted. I'm like, seriously? All right, fine.
Thanks, Dad.
So I went off and I worked. I worked tech for many years, and then I went back and I finally finished college on the 13-year plan, and started doing the DoD contracting. Yeah, I did my bachelor's in 13 years, and I did my master's in 12 months. So made up for it.
It works.
And then again, after I graduated, I'm like, cool, I can go join the military now. And my dad's like, why don't you just be a contractor? I'm like, okay. So I did that for a few years. And then I had some opportunities. I first went to Iraq in 06 and just did that cycle for about 5 years supporting programs. It was an adventure.
Yeah, I didn't realize you did it that many times.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry, I didn't mean to derail the conversation there.
No. Got out, for a couple of years, didn't really know what I wanted to do. Started a swim team, an aquatics program, was coaching. I tried doing the triathlete thing, trying to make some money as an athlete. No money in either of those. So I decided, I need to go to grad school. I need to do something else. Went to grad school for business analytics and economics. And that was in 16. That's when I started grad school. And that's about the time I started investing and trading. I had met my wife, and we kind of had a plan of, okay, we knew we wanted to get out of the financial system. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not going to do, like, I was determined. I'm not going to be like the farmers that I grew up with. I'm not going to work till I die. I'm not going to let my wife do that. I'm not going to put her in that position. Like, we're going to fucking figure this out.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'll try and maintain my profanity.
It's okay. This is a veteran pie. Yeah, we all have dirty mouths here.
So my initial plan that I kind of came up with while I was in grad school was kind of a four-layer plan. I had a 20-year layer, a 10-year layer, a 5-year, and a 2-year layer. And each one of those things had like a different component to it. One was investing and trading related, and one was real estate related. And so we started on that path, started on that plan. 16 is the first year I really started, you know, investing, trading, doing anything kind of on my own.
How did you even know that trading was like a thing? Like, how did you even get exposed to that?
At grad school.
Okay.
Taking business classes, learning about, just the basics of finance or finance, whatever you want to call it.
Anything through the farming side of things? Because the futures trade or that?
Yeah, I knew about futures. I knew before that going in that there was a way to, kind of hedge what the price might be in a year for, corn or soybeans or things like that. So I knew those were a thing. At the academy, we had some rudimentary financial training. It's basic stuff, but it is good stuff. Mm-hmm. Because, going to a service academy, your second class year, you get a career starter loan. When I was there, it was $30,000. And it's essentially just a loan you do have to pay back. But it's to help you kind of get started in your career. And USAA came in and did some, high level financial stuff like, hey, here's what this looks like. Here are your options. And they pitched, their services for, hey, you should start a retirement account. You should start an IRA. Like, you should have some kind, start investing somehow.
Yeah.
And so I was like, okay, that's fine. And so I had put some money away while I was at the academy and Didn't really do anything with it. But I had some senior enlisted that really preached real estate to me. And their approach was, hey, every time you go somewhere, buy a house. And then if you go somewhere else, buy another house and rent out the first one.
So I have a house in Mississippi.
Every time you go to a different place, buy a house and rent it out. And they had talked to me about it. So when I got out, like those were kind of the two things in my mind. Like, okay, rental real estate and, the stock market. And, I learned a little bit at grad school. I came across some guys who were on the track to go be quants and not just like, oh, they put quant in front of their name. Like, no, PhDs in mathematics. Like, they're still at Goldman Sachs doing the like high frequency trading shit. So I learned a little bit about it there. But I, admittedly in like 16, I didn't really know what I was doing. I just, was doing shares on, things that I was interested in. Yeah. And I was selling iron condors. That was how I got started. I was primarily an option seller. I looked at my numbers recently. My first year, I made 3%. First whole year.
If you're profitable your first year, that's still pretty good.
Most of the year I was not profitable. Mm-hmm. I turned profitable. Most of the year I was not profitable.
Okay.
My wife does not know that. Most of the year I was not profitable. But I did turn a profit. I did. Mm-hmm. And my account was small. It was $5,000 or something. Like I barely had enough money to do iron condors. Next year I leaned more into that. I was like, okay, I had figured some things out, had some more classes, talked to some more people at grad school. I was like, okay, I had a little bit more idea. My second year, I turned 12%, and I primarily leaned more into iron condors. At that time, I was like 50-50. So 50% long the market, 50% condors, because I basically was under the impression, like, I don't know what the hell the market's going to do. Iron condors are like, you don't know what it's going to do, but it tends to be range bound. So that's what I did. And okay, like I had some success there. And then third year, finished grad school. Third year, I kind of really figured things out. My last year in grad school doing the economics thing and getting into the corporate world, what I saw was lots of institutions using the 200-day as kind of their benchmark for is the market safe or not safe. Like that was their first line of risk defense. And so I was like, you know what? That makes sense.
Yeah.
I'll do that. And so, I'll kind of stop there. Like, so that got into the corporate world and my job there was to help companies essentially hedge their investing and growth plans based on the macroeconomic client. I was an economic consultant, helping them when they, were going to, expand into Indonesia, for example. Understand like what's the currency risk? What are the things we need to be considering if we're going to stand up a new product line here? Is it safe? Is this something that we can be doing at this point in time? Or does it make more sense to be more defensive and stockpile cash or, invest our money somewhere else?
Yes.
Part of the team that would come in.
Can I ask you a question about that? Just sure. Do you ever get that wrong? or do you ever worry about that? Like, is that something that keeps you up at night? Man, you're talking about some decisions there where you make the wrong call, it can cost somebody a lot of money. And if you make the right call, it could still cost them a lot of money if things don't line up right.
Yeah. And so that's a big part of it. And from the consulting firm's perspective, we were very restricted with what we could say and what we could not say.
Okay.
I could never say this is what's going to happen. And this really set the tone for how I still invest today and how I think about things. Everything is in terms of probabilities.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what's going to happen, but we have four scenarios. This scenario is, a 40% chance. This is a 30. This is, a 20. And this is a 10, right? And then, so here's the percent probabilities. And then we have, a scale of, well, how confident are we in these probabilities, right? Like this one, the probability this happens may be a 40% chance, but our confidence is very low because the data is weak or the data is, it's sparse, it's missing things. There's a lot of volatility in this area. So yeah, stuff like that comes into play. And that definitely feeds into how I still invest and trade today. Risk, like I am obsessed with risk management for a lot of reasons. But it is like, I have, I think 12 different factors into my rule set that are all risk management.
Okay.
Just different levels of things because, I refuse to go back to poverty. I refuse to let my family go back to where I came from. I have physical gold sitting 10 feet away from me. I have physical silver sitting 10 feet away from me, right? Like I have treasuries. I have,
is that like, physical gold sitting there next to you because it's not in a trading account and therefore not at risk, or is it because it's out of the system and not at risk?
Yes.
So yes. So, you mentioned rules a couple different times, and I think that's one of the things that I've noticed in Mike, and that's one of the things I've admired in Mike's trading, is how good he is with incorporating rules. Is that why you guys hit it off so well, do you think, Mike?
Probably, more than likely, yeah.
Yeah.
His trading style, I would agree, it aligns with me, the very structured way he trades, but also his fundamental looks at things as well as using technical analysis is what caught my attention the most.
And, yeah,
and that's the other thing that I've been hearing a lot of. There's a lot of data points, it sounds like, that you're kind of focusing in on, and that's something that we don't see a lot of in our world. As Mike, I think, mentioned pre-show, we mostly get technical analysis guys on here, so you might be one of our first, maybe our second or third actual, like, guy who even acknowledges that fundamental analysis actually exists. How did you come to that decision to incorporate both of the worlds as opposed to picking a side?
Well, so the quant guys that I knew, they really looked at things from both perspectives, building out their models.
Yeah.
They look at the technical side of, well, not all of them, but a lot of them look at the technical side of things, but they do, because they're working in Wall Street, like they have to consider the fundamentals. They are beholden to the fundamental analysis at some level. And, I had some people explain it to me as like, they're different sides of the same coin. Mm-hmm. To me, I think retail traders, and I do still consider myself a retail trader, they tend to go towards technical analysis because it's cheap and it's easily accessible, mm-hmm. right? Like it doesn't cost a whole lot to get charts. It's relatively easy to learn charts, whereas the fundamental analysis, that information is readily available too. But I think there's a perception of people that like you have to have a degree or you have to have some level of institutional knowledge to understand the formulas and the ratios, right? Like what's a price to free cash flow ratio, right? Like what's EBITDA mean? Like how do you read an income statement? How do you look at a balance statement? Like which of these numbers is just flat bullshit, like EBITDA, and which numbers do you care about? So like I think you can confuse a lot of retail traders, and that's why they tend to shy away from it.
Yeah.
And then there is too kind of the Warren Buffett mystique of, fundamental analysis is for the long term, right? Like you want to get a fair company at a good price instead of, a good company at a fair price. It's kind of a little more long term horizon, and retail traders tend to be a little more short-sighted. Want things a little more quickly. And some of that is because, again, on the institutional side of things, typically they do have governing bodies that dictate how long they hold things. It's not uncommon for firms to say like, hey, we're not going to take a position in something unless we do plan on holding it for a long time, pending all their risk criteria.
Right.
So I think that's why retail goes, kind of goes to one side or another. But to me, they're two sides of the same coin. The way I look at it for me is technical analysis is used for your entries, right? Like if you identify something that, is fundamentally sound. So one I've been on for months, and I'm sure Purdue has seen me stomp about, is ASML, right? Like fundamentally, the company is a great company, right? They have a monopoly in the AI world. Nobody can do what they can do. They're the only person that can provide the lithographs.
Yep.
They produce tons of free flow. And so, this is something I would like to be a part of, but I'm not just going to dollar cost average in and do that shit, like, because risk matters to me.
Mm-hmm.
And if risk matters, well, then you do need to consider technical analysis because there is something there. And all these people who say technical analysis only works because other people do it and because everybody uses it, well, I don't give a shit why it works.
It works. If it works, yeah. You're still saying it works.
If it fucking works, it works. I don't care. So to me, that's the way I look at it. Find something that fundamentally I want to invest in or trade in, and then flip over to the chart, pay attention to what's going on, pay attention to the market sentiment, and then dictate your entry from there. And I have rules based on that. My strategy is it's a 5-rule strategy. It's the one that I talk about a lot. And those dictate my entries, my exits, identifying trades, everything, all within
five rules.
It does my sizing, my profit taking, everything all within those
is
five.
It, so. Is it proprietary, or can we talk about the five rules?
No, we can talk. Absolutely. I talk yeah. about it all the time. It's all real right. simple.
Let's hear it.
So five things: higher lows, price support, higher highs, pattern break, and the 200-day. So either above or below the 200-day.
So Kyle.
Higher highs. Yeah, say again.
Put that on a chart. Draw out what he just said.
Yeah, is that Wyckoff, the Wyckoff shakeout that you're always looking at?
It's everything.
Yeah,
I would say that those five rules encompass 99% of all trading strategies in the market.
Say it one more time for us.
So, first thing you look for is a higher low,
mm-hmm.
a level of price support or resistance,
mm-hmm.
higher highs,
yep,
a pattern break, so either diagonal or horizontal.
Okay.
Change of character.
And yep. then the 200-day moving average.
I like that.
That's it.
What's your typical hold times on these?
Awesome.
About 45 days.
Okay.
So, but those numbers are skewed a little bit. I will caveat. Those numbers are skewed because a quarter of every position I take, I plan to leave on for as long as possible.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
GE is a good example. I've been in GE for 3 years.
Okay.
And it just keeps going. The chart has given me no reason to get out. So it, and I've made more money on the runners than I made off the initial trade.
Right.
Because I left a quarter of the size on and it just keeps going. So why would I stop? Gold's the other one.
Mm-hmm.
Gold has now become my largest trade ever. I've been in it for 2.5 years.
Oh, damn.
and it's not going to stop. And mm-hmm. I would say that too. Gold is nowhere near stopping. So,
I mean, that begs some questions there. Are you not a believer that inflation's going away?
Gold says that inflation is, gold is inflation. Yes, you want to see the chart of inflation? Look at gold.
Right.
Kyle, how do you say that with a straight face?
I tried. I almost got it out.
Not really.
Gold is inflation.
Yeah.
And it's not. So. But yeah, those are the five rules. They dictate everything, with the caveat of, again, a quarter of all positions I plan to leave as long as possible. Most of the time it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
95% of them, the trade will move up. You take profits on the way up. And then at some point it starts to turn around and come back. It goes below break even and I'm out. That's the thing. I don't hold a losing trade,
mm-hmm.
right? Like once it comes back and it hits break even, I'm out. But that quarter of the position, I'll leave it as long as possible. I try to leave leverage on when possible with leaps. But you know, eventually, you know, time runs out. And so I do take shares frequently with things mm-hmm. to try and do that, because then at least I'm getting something. No, I'm not getting, you know, 6x leverage on shares. But it's, you know, again, like with GE, even with no leverage, I've made more off of the runners than I did the initial trade.
Right. Huh. So. Sounds like you're executing on like a basket of different, God, what's the right? I can't think of the fucking terms today. A basket of different like products. You're not just options, you're shares, you're not just futures. You're kind of like a little bit of everything, it sounds like.
Yeah. Yeah. I do a little bit of everything depending on what account I'm operating in.
Mm-hmm.
Cause I have 8 accounts. Depending on, you know, which account I'm in, different ones have different sizes. 4 of those are retirement accounts. So my 401k, my wife's 401k, my IRA, her IRA. I have 2 trading accounts and then 2 wealth accounts. So the trading accounts have very kind of loose rules in terms of what I can buy or whatnot. I don't go shorter than 90 days mm-hmm. for options, because my average trade time is about 45 days.
Yeah.
At 45 days, theta kicks in yep. really hard. So I have to stay out past 90. I like to stay a little further out.
Are you typically going in the money, out the money? Like what sort of delta are you looking at?
So I like to stay around 50 delta.
So I'm pretty much near the money.
So that's pretty much at the money or a couple of strikes out. Again, depending on what the asset is, if there's, I don't go really far out of the money. At most, it'll be a couple of strikes out. Like if there's an obvious part or an obvious point on the chart where there's a lot of resistance and it looks like, okay, it may reject there or something. And it's a, you know, maybe 4 or 5 strikes out of the money. Okay, I'll go there.
Mm-hmm.
But no, usually it's at the money. And that's just because it's easier for me to control my delta and to understand what my risk is. Because every position is based off of risk. It's not like a flat, $1,000 per trade or 10 contracts per trade. Like everything is based off of risk. So, and then related to the rules really quickly. So I have 5 rules.
Mm-hmm.
If it meets all 5 criteria, it's a 5% position. If it meets 4, it's a 4% position. If it meets 3, it's 3. And I don't take anything less than 3 criteria. If it doesn't meet at least 3, I don't touch it.
I see some wheels turning over there, Bear. You liking that?
No, I just, I really like that.
Right?
Keep it simple approach to sizing and everything else. It's very, very clear.
Yep.
It's beautiful.
Yep. And it's that way because I came up with it while I was a consultant working 60, 65 hours a week. I didn't have time. I don't have time. Nope. To make these decisions. I don't have time to worry with the charts. I don't have time to watch it during the day. I could squeeze, 15 minutes at the market close to kind of check and see what things were going on. And, that's when I could enter positions. And then past that, I would just have my, profit taking orders and stop losses set, kind of as a bracket order and just leave them good till cancel or good till close.
Mm-hmm.
And so, by default, I just had to automate my trading. And that's how I ended up doing so well with Tesla in 19 and 20.
Oh, God. Yeah. If you kept a 25% runner on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I I went very heavy on the trade, but I was so busy that like when it first happened in October, it closed above the 200 day. It met 3 of my criteria, or actually it met 5. It met 3. At the time I only had 3. I didn't have all 5 back then. It met my criteria. I said, okay, I'm going to take it. And at the time I was doing 20% per position. So I would do 4 long positions and then 20% of my account for iron condors.
Mm-hmm.
And I had about a $60,000 account at the time. And I just went leaps with Tesla. I think it was like October 19th. Before they had the big run, and I didn't check it for like a week and a half. I didn't check it for a week and a half because I was flying back and forth to Boston, working on a client. Like the managing director was a real pain in the ass. And like, I was so busy. I didn't have time. And I pulled it up and my account had gone from $60,000 to like $400,000.
Jeez.
Yep. I remember that month very well. Yeah.
Yeah, like every day. Every day it was up like 70%.
So what'd you do at that point then?
Yeah.
I mean, I assume you closed some of it out, right?
Yeah. So immediately I closed like a quarter of the position
because
I was just like, I've never seen this much money. Like I have to close it.
Yeah.
But then, I had gotten like March 21, like 55s. So I actually, at that time I was buying out of the money.
Mm-hmm.
Because I didn't have a lot of money in my account.
Yeah.
Relatively. And I was like, okay, I'll buy a little bit at the money, but then I'm going to buy some out of the money. And so I just went as far out as I could. They were like 55s and the stock went to like $500. So the 55s were like
Jesus.
30 strikes in the money.
Right.
So I was able to close some of them, but a lot of them I didn't. Like the majority of the position, I wasn't able to close it because it just goes so deep in the money. You can't
find someone to execute that trade.
Yeah, you can't. Ah. I tried for weeks and you couldn't close them.
How big was the spread? Yeah,
so I ended up just having to execute them. But I mean, still made a shitload of money.
Worst things to complain about, right?
So in 19, my account, my returns were, I think, like 510%. Just because of Tesla.
Yeah.
And so then, after that, at that point, like, I had a conversation with my wife. I was like, okay, what do we do with this? And so it was like, okay, well, now we can do the real estate thing. Like we can get some rentals now, right? Mm-hmm. Like we can get some rental properties. So that was the plan. Let's close some of this out. Let's pull some money out. Let's get some rental properties. We went ahead and cleared the debt. We didn't have very much debt, but cleared the cars, didn't clear the house, but like set some money aside. And then I was working on a healthcare client at the time,
mm-hmm.
In end of 19. And they were really freaked out about COVID, really, really freaked out because they had business in China. And so they were seeing the medical data coming out of China, and they were really, really freaking out. And so that kind of got me paying attention to the market and paying attention to things. And yeah, so I ended up closing a lot of stuff in the beginning of January of 20, paying attention to the charts and seeing how things were escalating. And I also ended up going short oil in 20. I've got a story. I've got a story about that. Mike and I
Were you short when it went below zero?
I was. I didn't have any contracts. I think I had like three, but yeah, I was. My broker, I remember Charles Schwab calling and saying they were closing my position.
Oh, that's nice of him.
Because it's not supposed to go negative.
No.
It's like, wait, I think this is a margin call the other way.
Right.
Like, no, like you.
Yeah.
You owe me money. Yeah.
Yeah. You owe me money here. So, I know some guys that were short at the same time. They were the ones that had convinced me to pay attention to this and go short. And they flipped long, like a week later.
Yeah.
And fucking cleaned up. But yeah, I didn't do that. So yeah, I had shorted some airlines, was paying attention to the bond market. I was originally a very big, just like indexes, gold, bonds, oil. Like those were my four things, just the Qs, gold, bonds, and oil. And so, yeah, paying attention to the data, being an economist, when the market started crashing, like I was already in cash. I had some small short positions. I was short oil, made a little bit of money, made a decent amount of money. And then I remember when the Federal Reserve came out and said they're going to provide unlimited liquidity to the market. And I called a friend of mine, Mahadev. He was like the Indian quant that I went to grad school with. And me and him were both like everything. Credit cards, money in the couch. Like I told my wife, like anything. Find everything you can find. And I went, I bought four things. I bought Restoration Hardware, I bought Square, I bought Apple, and I bought Tesla. And I'd put in like, it's about $75,000 in each.
Why Square? What was Square doing at the time? I don't remember.
My thought was it was a payment services provider.
Ready to nerd out on the tech shaping tomorrow? Voices of Blockchain, the official podcast of Boston Blockchain Week 2025, is back for season two. We're featuring pioneers rocking Web3, AI, and blockchain innovation. So get the scoop on the people powering the next wave of innovation by subscribing now wherever you get your podcasts. And join us for the fun in September at bostonblockchainweek.com for the killer talks, epic vibes, and top-tier networking. And if you happen to run into me or my wife, come see us because we probably have unused drink tickets.
Eric, why should people listen to season two?
I'm really excited for season two because what's interesting is that we talked about the founding of America. You know, we set that foundation. And now we're going to watch America try and build a house that will become divided and burned down.
And, we're going to watch them fail spectacularly.
Yeah, we're going to watch them fail spectacularly. It's going to end with the nation ripping itself apart, the founding of the best Virginia, and, the suspending of habeas corpus. about as broad as you get it. But what's going to be cool is what emerges from season two is the foundation for the world's largest, most advanced economy.
You visit the website, buckstartsherepodcast.com, to stay up to date. We'll see you all next week. Longtime fans of the show should be familiar with the lender formerly known as Sue Pullen, and I'm pleased to announce that she's back, fresh off a rebrand and ready to help as Sue Mackey. Sue is a certified mortgage advisor at Fairway Independent Mortgage, an equal housing lender who focuses on finding the right product for you and your needs. She has over 20 years of experience helping thousands of homeowners. Whether it's purchasing, refinancing, or even a reverse mortgage, Sue will help. Sue's licensed in 36 states now, so reach out and let Sue Mackey it happen for you. The best way to reach her is just give her a call at 520-977-7904 or in an email, spullen@fairwaymc.com. Fairway Independent Mortgage has an MLS number of 2289. Sue Mackey has an MLS number of 206048. That email again, spullen@fairwaymc.com, and that phone number is 520-977-7904. Shoot Sue an email and let her know she needs to update that address.
Okay. Yeah.
So I was
e-commerce.
E-commerce. That was my thought. Restoration Hardware.
Yep.
My wife had done some work for them, some marketing work for them. It's just like rich people buying rich furniture. And she showed me some pictures of like their showroom and the bar that they had in their showroom. And like some of the best food she ever had in her life came from a Restoration Hardware. Huh. So I was like, yeah, rich people always have money.
Yes, they do.
I did call options on everything. I did, you know, like 14 to 18 month call options on everything, because we had pulled out about half of our money. And so I was like, okay, this is good. You know, in my mind, I still really, at that time, I wasn't thinking about like trading the options. It was like, okay, these are 18 month options. So I'll check on them. You know, I have 18 months to hold them and see where they go. My returns for 2020 were north of 13,000%.
All right, we just want to make sure everyone understands that, as we said in the beginning, this is not the normal path.
This is not normal. Like, I'm happy to share my story with people so they can see kind of what's possible. But I always tell everyone,
that's the point there, I think. This is what happens if you're prepared and you have a solid plan and a solid understanding of how to execute that plan. When you're prepared and the opportunity strikes. Yeah, sorry, Mike, go ahead.
No, that's fine. I just thought you were up to you. I think the bigger point to all of that led up to it is that he adapted his trading to fit his lifestyle.
Yes. Going to swing trading at the beginning. Yeah.
Yes. Yep. And Cam and I really didn't really meet until this year or later in this year. And that's kind of like the path that I've gone. It was where my trading needs to adapt to my lifestyle. I don't have time for day trading futures every day. And I've backed off of it, and it's changed humongously for me. Yes, it's an ultra bull market and blah, blah, blah. But he has a perfect example of where he put himself in a situation where trading fit his lifestyle and how well it worked.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we had a very similar conversation with Flurry a few weeks ago in that he did the same thing. He had a lifestyle change, and he had to change his trading to something that he could do in 20 minutes a day. Mm-hmm. His results improved exponentially as well.
Yeah.
And you know, I went through a similar path in spring of 2020, and Tesla and options and absolutely insane returns, but I didn't have the history. I didn't have the tools. I didn't have the knowledge, and I gave it all back.
Yeah.
Actually, are you the first person we met who didn't give it all back? Or did you?
No.
Okay. No. Not yet, at least.
No, I've had some losses.
Yeah, I have.
I've had some big ones. But I didn't. After it ran end of 2020, I just kind of stepped away from trading. Mm-hmm. Because everything changed. Everything changed. I remember watching, like looking at my phone and watching it go up by like 15,000, 20,000, like 20,000, 20,000, 20, like, because things were jumping so hard back then. When it started running, like I closed things out. You know, I ended up closing, I closed like a third of the position pretty early on, but I left two thirds of it again, because I was so busy and I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to do. I'd never seen $10 million. I didn't know what to do.
Right.
I'd never seen first world problems.
Too many zeros. What do I do?
Well, hang on. There's something to that, though. I mean, that's when mistakes get made, when you hit
uncharted
territory.
Yeah, we had started looking into real estate, and we had met an attorney, and I called, and they worked at a firm that does tax. They do tax, accounting, and legal. Like they do all of them. And so they put me in touch with some people to talk to me about, okay, like there are going to be big tax implications.
That was my next question, actually.
Like you need to consider what happens here when you sell these, when you, like what you do. So that went into it all. End of the year, closed out most of the position. I had some going into 21. And then 2021 pretty much didn't touch anything. So I retired in May of 20, because the account was just going up so much, and the firm wanted me to travel one day, and I was just like, you know what?
Have you seen my Tesla account?
You know what?
Oh man, that must have been a great day.
No,
I'm good, but thanks. No, thanks.
Yeah. Yeah, I was like, no, I'm not working 60 hours a week anymore. Like I liked consulting, but it was never the end goal. It was a means to an end.
Did you fly first class to like go see him in person to tell him, no, I'm not doing this anymore?
No, because this was during COVID. So everything was remote. Yeah, it actually happened. They did like a 2-week break where it was like, okay, nobody's flying. Nobody's going anywhere. The firm is going to kind of figure things out. Like all these restrictions are coming down. Like, what are we going to do? And after that 2-week break, I was like, yeah, I'm not coming back. I'm done. And then I told my wife was working at a consulting firm too. And I was like, yeah, you're not going back either. And I told my parents and my grandparents and her parents and her grandparents, I was like, y'all are done. God. Let me know everything. What do you have? You're done.
Nope. Nobody's working anymore.
Nobody's working anymore.
That's awesome.
How did it feel to be able to do that for your family?
That was never in the cards. Like I had never, that never occurred to me. I was just concerned with like me and my wife.
Yeah.
Let's have enough money through like rental properties and like, you know, long-term investments that like, yeah, we can leave our jobs and we can decide what we want to do, right? Like we can live debt-free. We can be responsible, you know, keep our expenses under control. We can have a house, you know, and have a nice, comfortable life. But mm-hmm. like, it was never that. Like I didn't know you could do that. You know, you see like athletes do that and things, but like, again, for somebody who grew up, you know, pulling tobacco and driving tractors up and down the road, like, what do you think? No, that's, it didn't occur to me.
Yeah.
But yeah, I had that, you know, I had all that money in my accounts and it was like, I got to do something with this. Like, this is more than we need. Like, so I'm going to take care of them. I'm going to take care of my brother. And that's who we support to this day. And my brother decided he did want to work. You know, I told him, like, I gave him a sum, put it in an account. And I was like, you can do with this what you want. If you want me to manage it for you, you know, and do dividends so you can live off of it, you can do that. He decided he wanted to continue working. He was trying to do minor league baseball at the time. It didn't work out. So he had ended up going to have to get a job. He actually ended up working at Tesla. funny enough, he worked there for a little while. He was on the supercharger team.
Okay.
Cool.
And then, when they let go of them year before last or last year, when they were like, oh no, fuck you guys, we don't need you anymore. And then like in Elon fashion, like a week later, they were like, oh no, come back. He was like,
nah.
No, I'm taking the severance. I've got money. So
like when you lose the need to work, do you worry about losing like your, I guess, reason for existing? Like you almost have to like plan for that, you know? Like,
yeah, that was, yeah, there, we went through a period. Yeah. In 2021 after the dust settled and figured things out where it was, what do we do? And so we still wanted to do rental real estate. And it ended up being like, okay, we need to do this for tax reasons.
Mm-hmm.
We need to buy some real estate for depreciation and cost segregation and things like that to offset the tax hit. You know, we need to move the money out of our individual accounts and put it into, you know, entities and put it into, you know, a corporation and things like that for tax purposes. And some of it was, yeah, okay, what do we do now? And so, yeah, we had to figure that out. We got involved in different things. You know, my wife has her stuff that she gets, you know, that she does. You know, I won't speak to her stuff, but she's got things that she's interested in. Our health became a big thing right away. What do we need to do to get healthy? You know, we're going to stay active. You know, what are our long-term goals?
Hey, you got money. You want to live long enough to enjoy it, right?
Yeah. Like, let's get healthy. Let's figure things out. But then, some of it for me was, I know this now. I didn't realize it at the time. But I kind of wanted to see like, hey, did I just do this because I was lucky?
Right.
Right. Like, are we just here because I was lucky? And so I still wanted to like trade and invest. I think initially to kind of prove that like, it wasn't just because I was lucky.
Right.
Like I did actually have an idea of what I was doing and I put myself in a position to get lucky.
Yeah.
And I maintain now that that's what it was. I had come up with a good plan and a good strategy and there was some luck there. Absolutely.
Dude, but that's just, everybody sees the result of this lucky situation, but they miss all the other situations that you were there, like present for, that didn't work out that way, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's definitely part of it. And, you know, one of the things that kind of does, I think about it all the time, is if that trade presented itself to me tomorrow, mm-hmm. would I make more money? Because I should make more money, because now I have 10 years of experience. Now I've been through this. Now I have a better understanding of options and futures and things. And so, like, in theory, if I had that same trade happen tomorrow on, ASM,
would you make, like, more money? Or would you
make,
I think you make less, because you probably know better now how to, like, manage risk. Whereas usually you make those bigger gains because you're not, you know, following exit strategies as well as you probably should have.
It's like exponential risk.
Yeah.
Exponential risk. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's something I'm not every day, but every week I think about it. All the time,
mm-hmm.
you know, would I do that again? What would I do differently? And so that's why I'm constantly thinking about my rules and thinking about my systematic approach to things. Because, I mean, yes, at the time, like, looking back on it, like, okay, it's an electric car company. And, like, yeah, electric cars could be the future. And, like, you know, I saw the hype around it, but I don't do hype. I don't do hope. Hope is for blowing up the Death Star. Like, it's not for investing, right? Like, you know, like, so, like, how do I know if, I think I have 12 positions in my swing account, like, how do I know that one of them's not going to go 10,000% next week?
Mm-hmm.
The odds are they won't. Right? The odds are astronomically that they won't. But if one does, will I get better returns? So I'm constantly thinking about that. Like, how do I put myself in a position to get lucky? Because you never know when something's going to happen. And most likely, yeah, it's not going to do that. It's going to do what GE did, right? Mm-hmm. Like, again, I'm in GE for years, right? Like, I rode NVIDIA for a little bit. But NVIDIA is a good example. I got out,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, I was in NVIDIA when it had its big run. I wasn't in very heavy. I'd actually sold some puts instead of going long. I sold some puts to buy some calls to pay for the call premium. Because even now with a huge account, I'm still cheap. I want an infinite return, right? Like, yeah. Okay, 10,000% is good, but I want infinite, right? Like, I want a free position to go.
Right, right.
But I got out of it. Yeah. I got out of NVIDIA, right? Like, I made money on
it. What's your exit criteria now? Is it just 200-day moving average, close below? Something like that? Simple as that?
So I go by the charts for exit criteria. So one of my rules is higher highs.
Mm-hmm.
Those higher highs have to be included in the pattern, right? So if you have a diagonal pattern, it must be made up of your higher highs.
Okay.
And there have to be at least three. Two higher highs don't make a pattern.
Yep.
Three make a pattern. Those are my exit criteria, right? Like, you'll ideally enter at the first one,
mm-hmm.
sell at the second higher high, sell at the third higher high. And then if it gets to all-time highs, I always sell a quarter of the position there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If it gets there.
Yeah.
And then I always leave a quarter on. So 50% of my account is, or 50% of the position is runners and all-time highs.
Mm-hmm.
So that leaves 50% to be sold somewhere between when I enter it and all-time highs, if all-time highs are available. Usually I just go by the top of the pattern, right?
Yeah.
Like, so usually by the time it gets to the pattern top, I want to be at least half out.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, again, like, if I also have rules, like, if it has a two standard deviation move in a day, right? Like, a couple of weeks ago, what was it, like, SMR and Oklo, they moved up like 25% in a day.
Okay.
Well, I'm closing a quarter of the position.
Right, right, right.
Right, because those, like, you're getting IV bump there.
Right, right, yes.
I want to capture that IV bump, because even if price stays flat or drifts up the next day, your options are going to lose money because the IV is going to collapse.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, when you get a huge move like that, the IV, implied volatility, in case anybody doesn't know that term yet.
Oh, yeah, sorry, implied volatility. Good to
explain. Yeah.
So, yeah, usually that's what it is. I go by the chart, I find clear levels there or gaps. If there's a gap on the chart, I'll always sell when mm-hmm. it gets to the bottom of the gap, because the first time it touches it, it's going to reject it. Unless there's a lot of momentum, unless there's a lot of heat going through it. So I'll pull back there.
I've been monopolizing a lot of this time here. So Mike, Barry, you guys got any questions you wanted to pose here before we run out of time?
Sorry, we're missing the fundamental side of how he searches for some of his picks.
Okay.
Because he's talked about the technical side. Where's the fundamental side?
Yeah. So a pause for a second and say, I don't always use a fundamental approach. It's not for like 100% of my positions, but for a lot of them it is. But I am always looking on the fundamental side for potentials. Mm-hmm. And so I look for four things for fundamentals. I look for quality, value, liquidity, and momentum.
Okay. So how do you define those?
So quality, you can define it a lot of different ways. For me, I care about cash flow and basically money, right? Like I don't care about anything
else. Debt to income ratio, anything like that? Or
so I look at earnings per share growth. Mm-hmm. Year over year, I want to see at least 25%. Okay, so that's the filter there. For value, I look at the market cap to free cash flow ratio. So you take, you know, if it's a $2 billion company like Netflix, divide it by their cash flow, and you're going to get a whole number. Well, maybe not a whole number. You're going to get a number between, you know, zero to, you know, 300 or 400.
What is that telling you? Yeah, sorry.
So the lower number. So I'll give you an example. So earlier this year when I took, or this month when I took ASML and Netflix were both $500 billion companies, right? But if ASML is making $200 million a year and Netflix is making $100 million a year, so the price to free cash flow ratio for ASML is going to be 10.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And for Netflix, it'll be 20.
Okay.
So
okay.
You're paying more per market capitalization point for Netflix than you are for ASML.
Okay.
Right? ASML is a bigger company, but it's making more money. So if I came to you and said, okay, here are two ATM machines. They cost the same amount of money, but this one will give you $100 and this one will give you $50. I want the one that's going to give me $100, not the right one that's going to give me $50.
Yeah.
Right? And that's how people should look at stocks, because essentially, in theory, that's what you're buying. You're buying an ATM machine.
Well, isn't there a difference though between just free cash flow versus actual like revenue or net income, I should say, versus gross?
And so you can use any number of metrics. You could use like the peg ratio.
Yeah.
So, you know, price to earnings growth. That's just the one that I like to use.
Yeah.
Because it's relatively simple, right? It's just market cap divided by free cash flow.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives you a number that's easy to understand. And so that number I filter to greater than 10 and less than 50.
Okay.
Because over 50, it's getting kind of expensive. Even if they're making a lot of money, like Berkshire Hathaway, right? Like all they do is print money. but like the ratio isn't that good. Then for liquidity, it's $2 billion or more for market cap. So I don't want to see small caps. And then for momentum, I look at compression of the 20-day, the 50-day, and the 200-day. So I essentially want all of those moving averages.
Kind of like squeezing in. Yeah.
Squeezing in. I want them all to be within 3% of each other.
Interesting.
And so if you filter for that, and I have this in the room that I run, I regularly run this screener and spit out stocks. You filter for those four criteria. The back test says if you buy and hold them for 1 year, anything that meets those criteria, you get an average win rate of about 70% and an average win of about 30%.
Over what time frame?
A year.
No, how the data set that you've analyzed.
Oh, I've taken it back 12 years.
Okay.
12 years. And the catch there is the 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
Hold it longer than 1 year, your returns start to drop.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so that's the idea behind the momentum.
Mm-hmm.
It does include a little bit of the trading aspect, right? Like this shows that the company is a quality company, but it's underpriced and it's showing momentum that price is compressed and about to move. But that doesn't mean it's going to move forever, right? Like essentially once it gets fairly priced, price will stabilize and then maybe drift down.
Distributes.
Yep.
Yeah. And
yep.
Then it comes back. So the holding time there is very critical. 1 year.
Dude,
so,
I love that.
So you said not more than 1 year is 1 year, you know, so 1 year is kind of the peak is 1 year of the optimal point. Or are you looking at it at like a 6 month and a 9 month point and going, we're starting to hit that plateau?
Yeah. Yeah. I would say, I would do that. And for me, at nothing else, I would recommend, you know, taking, always leaving runners, but leaving the majority of your position when you make lower highs and lower lows. because that's the opposite of my strategy.
Yeah. When you see the opposite start to print. Yeah.
Yeah. And it works for reversals. Look at Jack in the Box. That's a reversal I'm in right now. It's showing all the criteria. It's going to go, it works for breakouts and continuations. And then if you just inverse it, it'll find you shorts. I've been in AMD for a while now. I keep seeing people trying to go long AMD and my puts are up 100%.
It's like Mike's in there with you.
So it works. The strategy, and that's why I like it. It's very simple, but if you invert it, it'll find you potential shorts too.
Okay. So you mentioned a couple names there. AMD was one. ASML, like if you want to see a good example of a long example of your strategy, a good example of a short was which one?
Yeah. AMD is one. If you look at RSP, so the equal weighted SPY, it triggered a sell for me earlier this week. Mm-hmm. I went short on it. But honestly, that's more of a defensive position.
Yeah.
That's just like, hey, it's a 3% position. It's just to protect my longs in my portfolio in case the market does roll over and really start to shit the bed. This gives me protection for everything else and gives me a little bit more time to get out. And that's part of my strategy. I have, again, hedging. We could talk about some other time and get into like, you know, how I hedge my portfolios.
Yeah, the beta weighted hedge analysis.
I have levels like, you know, if VIX is above 15, I do certain things. If there's a 2% down day on SPY, I'll do a certain thing. If my cash if I'm, you know, more than 50% allocated in my portfolio, I have a strategy I put on. I never go more than 90%. Mm-hmm. Never, ever go more than 90% allocated. I always leave at least 10% for hedging.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, I refuse to go back to where I came from.
Yeah.
I refuse to do that. So.
Well, I mean, the further up you go, the less risk of that, right? In theory.
That's one reason why I'm still doing this at this point. It's like, yeah, the bigger the stack gets, the bigger the pile gets, the more safety we have. But honestly, also, it gives more opportunity to do things that make a difference.
Yeah.
We have lots of causes and things that we get involved in. We don't just give money away, but you know, if there's an organization, there's one right down the road here in Tampa. They train guide dogs or service dogs for veterans.
Dude, I did that. My first grade class, we trained two guide dogs as part of that. Yeah. That was a lot of fun.
Anything they need, I've told them.
Yeah.
Anything you need, call me.
Dude, I mean, I love what you're doing with the vets too, man. That's another, that one, you know, straight to my heart because, you know, that my cause, I guess, you know, yeah.
Yep. So yeah, there's an organization that can show, hey, like money is really the issue, right? Like we have everything we need.
Mm-hmm.
We just need money. And you can prove to me that, you know, your organization isn't corrupt. Like you're really going to do these funds. You're really going to use these because we've been scammed with that. We've given some money to places and come to find out that it didn't really do what they said it was going to do. Mm-hmm. So we're cautious about that, but yeah, visit organization and like, mm-hmm. Hey, you guys really need this money. We will help out in any way that we can if money's the issue. Cause we have more than we need. My family's taken care of, but yeah, if I can help other vets, you know, if it's housing or, you know, education or scholarships or whatever, we don't have unlimited money, but that's one reason why I'm still trading because like, hey, we've got as much as we need, but like there are people that don't.
Mm-hmm.
And like, if I can help them, then I'm going to do what I can, you know, like what else am I going to do with my time? I want to help other people because like, we're not meant to be slaves to a system. And I don't want to get on my soapbox, but like, we're not meant to be stuck in these 9-to-5 dead end jobs, you know, burdened with debt. Like we're meant to be free.
Yes.
And that's the whole point with my room too. It's like, look, if you're willing to put in the work and you really want to learn how to trade and you know, my style suits you, a heavily, heavily rule-based system, I'll give you everything I have. I'll tell you everything that I can. I'll give you everything that I have to help you get out of the system if that's what you want.
And Mike, so. I think you can attest to everything you just said there.
100%. I mean, most of the time it's just me and Cam shooting the shit. I mean, but yeah, you know,
it's new.
It is. I mean, he has a lot of data in his room. Frankly, I haven't gotten through it all myself.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's not even, frankly, between Cam and I, it's even for me on the business side, him, and I bouncing off ideas of other revenue streams, other profit centers and so forth. That's where I've found a lot of knowledge and a lot of experience. And he's been places already that I want to go here soon. So I've really thoroughly enjoyed picking his brain a little bit.
Is he part of the reason? Because you've been like the last year or so, like the work that you put in your business has really been like supercharged. It's
completely coincidental.
Okay.
I've kind of doubled down on my business. I stopped day trading so much in futures, went strictly mostly option trading, and both my business and my trading are night and day difference.
I have we have businesses. I own a laundry, billboards. At one point we had 24 short-term rentals. We sold off a lot of those.
What's the cost to rent a billboard these days?
That's a long conversation that him and I had, and yeah. I was trying to get one of my property, but the stupid city won't allow it.
Billboards are one of the, I tell people they're one of the kind of forgotten things, you know, potential small business ideas. But when you look around, they're fucking everywhere. They're not super expensive. $250,000 for a double-sided, a double-sided digital one, a single-sided static one, $50,000, depending on, where you're getting your stuff from and, the tariffs and
what can I get? What can I get for $1,000?
So there's some, I will say there are some creative financing ways you can get into them. With like seller financing and stuff like that can be possible. With billboards. Once they get going, it's like a rental property. You just have a management company do the advertising and do the maintenance and everything. They basically cut you a check. You might cash flow $3,000, $4,000 a month you get it paid off. And then once it gets paid off, you can either sell it to, like Safeway or one of the other big boys. Or now your cash flow goes to, $6,000 or so if you're in the right market in a good location. That's possible. We have billboards, laundry, like I say, rental properties. So we've tried a bunch of stuff. Like I had a cell phone tower, at one point I was able to get out of that. Don't do that. Don't fucking do
those. I think my uncle tried to do that shit.
Cell phone tower only makes sense when you already own the land and you're just selling a lease. That's the only time that makes sense.
Yeah.
And that's the same thing with the billboards. If you own the land, like I do, it's a win.
Getting the lease for the land. We tried a lot of things. I've tried to do pretty much everything within the small to medium sized business world and fucked up a lot. I've lost.
You've learned some useful lessons.
Yeah, right? I've had a broker try and sue us. She found out that we had money and thought that our money was in our name and tried to come after us because we didn't use her to close a deal. And it's like, sorry, actually we don't own like anything in our name. Like we have nothing in our name.
Sucker.
And also that wasn't a fucking contract I signed. That was something you wrote on a piece of paper. That didn't go well, but yeah, I've made mistakes. I lost $190,000 on AbbVie on a trade.
Oh my God. All right. Well, I think you've set the stage for us to invite you back for another time. I think I'm pretty sure I speak for everyone here when I say I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation.
Sure. I'm happy to help. Yeah. Again, anytime, if my experience can help other people, I'm happy to go through it. I'll go through it. I'm happy to talk dollar figures. I'll be as transparent as people want. I avoid those because
it out of reach for people. Percentage should make everything applicable.
So, my swing account, one of the things I do, I reset it on a regular basis, right? And so I've been resetting it since COVID, right? So it's not, my returns since COVID have been about 300% a year, but every month I'm pulling money out.
Yeah.
I'm pulling money out. So it's not like going to a million and then 3 million and then 9 million and then no. It comes back and gets reset. And, new traders, if you're growing a small account, I know it makes it harder, but greed is your biggest enemy, right? And just trying to chase those huge numbers and see that exponential curve, that will kill you. Don't
Every time I try to hit that fast forward button is when I end up having a setback.
Which
Don't do that. Yep.
Cam has also helped me with as far as like some guidelines, as far as my own checks and balances, my own portfolio about what percentage I have in Tesla, what percentage I have in this.
Mm-hmm.
And he understands like sometimes I'm a little bit over that because my account is not that large, but you know, it's still bringing that thought process in mind more so.
Yeah,
the dollar amount.
Thinking of it more of a holistic portfolio balance as opposed to just individual trades.
Yeah,
dude, I love that, man. I mean, we're hitting the 1 hour mark, so I think we got to probably wrap up for today. So, everybody, please join me in thanking Bear, Purdue, and our special guest Cam. You can do that by clicking on all of Cam's links in the show notes. You can subscribe on your platform of choice, or you can email me your own wonderful guest suggestions over at chinashopproductions@gmail.com. We'll be back soon with another exciting episode. But till then, have a green week.
This podcast is intended for informational and educational purposes only. It does not constitute financial or investment advice and should not be construed as such. The hosts, guests, and contributors of this podcast are not licensed financial advisors, brokers, or professionals. Any trading or investment decisions made based on the content of this podcast are solely at the listener's discretion and risk. Trading and investing in financial markets carry inherent risks, and past performance is not indicative of future results. Listeners should conduct their own research and seek advice from qualified financial professionals before making any financial decisions. The views, opinions, and information shared in this podcast are those of the individual contributors and do not necessarily reflect the views or policies of the podcast creators or associated organizations. Produced by China Shop Productions.